Accession number 2008, reel 14.
Dennis Wybar, reel 14.
After sorting out the bodies, we came back to we was on the Murray Quarters in Kimbo Airfield at the time, and we sat down there, and Hursty, the crew commander, wrote to the bloke what was killed parents, because he wasn't married. We hadn't got his parents' address. We got his young lady's address, and then that was we wrote to her and got her parents' address, and of course we put a letter together, you know. It was a difficult job, even for a, you know, intelligent bloke like he was, I suppose, to break news to people, to say how sorry we was about losing him, but there was nothing we could do. And then things went on from there. We went back up on Imjin River in a different place again for a few months, you know, messing about up the hills. And
were you in static positions at that point?
Well, we was just getting to the static positions then. When I come home, we got right up the tops of the hills with the Centurions and got them in so that they could fire. We got a fair field of fire. We always took to the hills if we could get up. Because we always reckoned that, you know, if you're up on a hill and you're looking down on somebody, you've got a fair chance. But if you're at the bottom of the hill, they can come down and get you quicker. We learnt that. But the Yanks never would go off a raid. They didn't seem to want to take the main features, you know, and hold it. They thought driving up the road was all the thing. They had to learn the hard way, which they did do after the winter of chaos, really. And then they found out that to move forward and consolidate and take the main features, and that was the thing. To get, once you've got the main features, you've got that more or less out of hand. So until then, and then that was getting near my time to come home, and they got a lot of young blokes coming out there were going to relieve us, like the advance parties and that. And I said to the squadron leader, it's about time I got out the tank crew. And he said, well, I think we can manage it now, he said. So he put me on his personal half-track, and I was just having to look after his half-track and tow his caravan, you know. He had a caravan there. That was my lot. I had a 0.5 Browning on it. But
So when were you due to go home then?
Oh, I didn't know when. I didn't know when they was going to release us. I mean, we was over our time, and I don't know when. Anyway, we'd got this encampment ready for the winter, you know. We dug into the hills, at the bottom of the hills, and got the main dug into the side so we could cover it and put a space heater in it or something for the winter. And I mean, the blokes what were coming were in clover to what we'd been in the year before with nothing. But we'd already prepared to this, and then the order come, they said I was going home. And this was November time.
So what had you done through the summer period from, I mean, the Imjin Buckles were in April. What had you done through the May and June?
Well, we'd been up on the Imjin River and, you know, took our turns up there and come back. And we didn't do any more attacks, not that I can remember.
So you would only, what would you do, range on the Chinese positions?
Yeah, far, and then there was nothing much we could do. You see, that become kind of a stalemate until, I think, a night or two night. The night Speakman won his VC. Yeah, you remember that? The Chinese attacked a hill, And I remember lying in the bed and hearing all this lot, and I said, no, not again. You know what I mean. You know when there's real trouble and when there's just a paltry thing. But they apparently attacked this hill, and of course the Commonwealth Brigade had formed then, so they got a CRA, Commander Royal Artillery, and that makes a hell of a lot of difference. So they held the hill for a certain time and then pulled off, come right off it. Speakman went to ground, he remained there, didn't he? And all the CRA done was brought every blinking gun in the thing and just pounded it for the rest of the night. And they walked up the hill and took it back next day. And that was the last real big attack of the war, I thought.
I think that may have been in September. September.
I can't be sure of my dates, you know. It's September. Because they called me back to the squadron, and then I went to the regiment and mixed up with about 12 of us, and I didn't know any of them. They didn't come from my squadron. We went to Seoul railway station, and they took all our arms and everything off us and put us on the train to Pusan. We went and started off that night, and we got a good bed halfway down Korea, I suppose. I don't know where exactly it was. We got to stop. The partisans, or whatever they call them, the Reds, had come down from the mountains and raided the railway station, so we had to stay there till the morning. They'd shut up all the station when we went through the next morning. They had no arms, not even the sidearms. They took them all off us before we went. So we got down there and we were stripped off, bathed, you know, went through the baths and that, and measured up, and all new uniforms and bloody tapes and metal ribbons and Christ knows what stuck on us. And we had a barely tow. I think we was there about 4 or 5 days. Then we got on the Empire Ferry. Now, we should be out there. I don't know exactly when it was. That was November, must have been. Sometime in November when we got on the Empire Ferry. Got there, went. I was paraded up, you know, on a ship's RSM. Of course, it was all the Gloucester Regiment on there, and there was 12 of us who were just making up numbers, I suppose. And I was detailed off for being in charge of the deck sweepers for the journey. I thought, well, that's lovely. That's a nice job, because Tom, when I come out before, I was in the galley cutting up the bread and butter, you know, a bread and butter machine. And the boat was going this way, and the bread and butter machine. Anyway, I was in charge of the deck sweepers. I didn't know the names of any of the deck sweepers or where they went, and they was always piping up from the ship's RSM office to find the deck sweepers, you know. And of course, we got as far as Hong Kong. Of course, and then the boat stayed in there for a day, and all the Gloucesters were taken off. We was left on, you know, like odd buds, and they were paraded all around bloody Hong Kong, and we still set off for Singapore from there. We got to Singapore. And that piped us up over the ship's system, you know. Report that the office, there was 12 of us. We had to get our kit bags out of the holds, and our sea kit bags. We was took off a boat, put into lorries, taken across the island to the naval depot. It was in there, bloody great aircraft carrier, a Warrior. They put us on board that and said, be ready to dress ship, and we're off in some time, about an hour or so later. They reckon they was going to sail. They piped us up and then they come across, piped up a stand down, they got a breakdown. We won't be leaving at the time, so I thought, this is good, I'm not going to get back for Christmas at this rate. I was hoping to get back for Christmas. My boy's birthday was on the 21st of December. That's all we were thinking about. And anyway, that day, 12 hours later, they apparently had discovered the defect and rectified it. By that time, we was in the Navy. We all got our watch guards and everything, you know. And I said, Christ, it's a hell of a job. You're coming back here, getting bloody jobs. I mean, they'd taken this bloody boat out there with reinforcements, and they were picking up, I'll tell you what they had on board, battleship anchors on the flight deck. They had them all anchored down on the flight decks, and they got crashed aircraft and all, you know, a load of rubbish they were bringing back. And anyway, they got gone, and we was given our sponsors, you know, the guns, what we got to look after, and every morning we had a parade under the Master at Arms on the, you know, where the anchor deck was, and we was detailed off to giving our jobs. They took us up every morning for PT. Oh, yeah, they're giving us PT on the flight deck, and then you would have a bit of this deck hockey with a bit of rope, you know, and messing about. And we started off at the Indian Ocean. That cheered me up a lot to see the speed that boat was going through there, that aircraft carrier. I don't know how many knots that was doing. But we went across the Indian Ocean to Aden, just like that. And I thought, well, we had a couple of days in Aden. First a port watch went ashore, and then the starboard watch, we got ashore, and of course, we went there. I don't know exactly, couldn't really tell you where it was, somewhere where there was a naffy. There's a place called Little London near Aden, a kind of a village where all that. We went into this naffy and we got quite a few drinks, because they only paid us out a set amount, you know, and that was very little. Because we weren't in the Navy, but they were paying us out, and they wouldn't pay us out any amount of money, so we had a good drink or two and come back with the crew. By that time, we got friendly with the crew and all that. Coming back, all these natives in this, what they called London, Little London, I say, they all slept out on verandas on rattan beds, you know. And of course, these matlows were all loaded up, and they got across. They thought, oh, we'll tip them out of bed, because these people come down and they stand us like anything, you know, right down to the harbour. And we was getting aboard the boats to get out to the ship, you know. They stoned us like anything. One thing stuck in my mind, there was a kind of a concrete wall just down by where we went to get on the boat. And we were standing there waiting for the others to come. And this bloke was throwing bricks at us like nobody's business. And he threw a brick and bent down beside this wall. And there's a big old matlow come round and right behind him, and he put his boot right beside his head. I bet he had a headache for a month. Now, mind you, there was a few, got cuts and bruises out of it, but that's just the way it happened, I don't know. Then from there, we had a, of course, the start of the Suez Canal business was on then when we came home, 51. They just started, didn't they? We had to man all the guns going through the canal, you know. There was, they were getting stroppy, weren't they, at the time. We went through there and then we went to Malta. We didn't go in the Grand Harbour, we went round the other side to the RAF drone. I can't think of the name of the place, where the RAF drone was. And they ferried all these planes out, useless, I suppose, scrap ones. They ferried them all out and on rafts, you know, and then lifted them aboard and took them down below. And then we moved into the Grand Harbour. We had 2 or 3 days in there, and I was getting a bit worried about this business, getting home. But we sailed from there, we got to Plymouth on the 19th of December, which was a paying off place for that boat. So they paid off most of the crew, took off most of the crew what started from there, left us on, and the rest, we had manned the boat right while it got through to Portsmouth, you know. They had a skeleton crew like to take it round to Portsmouth. We docked there in Portsmouth on the 20th, I think. Next morning. Or was it the afternoon of the 20th, I think? Better afternoon, I think. And we had to go to Bovington from there, us, the 12 of us. We had to wait on Portsmouth Station for about 2 hours. And the buffet was open, and that was all. We got some money. We'd also got our kit bags full of stuff out the ship stores, what we bought, to take home with the money we got. A few of them got well tanked up on the station waiting for that train. Anyway, we got to Wool Station, about 7 o'clock, I suppose. It was dark, and there was some flipping sergeant major out there with a lorry, shouting out and bawling his, from Bobbington. Of course, these blokes, I don't think we ought to put this on there. These blokes have been drinking and on a non-corridor train, and this bloke shouting again. It was dark, so they all got back in the lorry and started relieving themselves out the back of the lorry. Of course, the sergeant major came by and I never heard so much language in all my life. The blokes just laughed at him, it made it worse, I suppose. And then they took us in the lorry up to Bovington camp. About after we'd been there about an hour, they paraded us and we had to hand all this stuff back, what we got. We had to come back with full kit. So we had to hand all that in, more or less, what they didn't want, except the uniforms. And we got to send them back once we got home, They give us a label to send them back. But we'd done that, and then an officer that we took us in the mess hall, and he stood up and he said, "I'm sorry, chaps," he said, "we won't be able to get you home for Christmas." You never heard the likes. You wouldn't think 12 men would make such a mouth for you. Anyway, I wouldn't listen the more to him, so he had to go off. And I suppose they went round and considered what had happened. And they got a scratch medical to him. by 10 o'clock, and they paraded us all again and give us a medical, which was a very preliminary, worse than what we had when we went in, I think. And that was it. We went to bed. Next morning we was called out there, and I think the first train was about 7:30. We was given £2 apiece and a ticket, one-way ticket home. Every man was given £2 apiece. And that's the last money I see at the army for about 2. Well, I got home on the 21st, I think, my son's birthday. And as I walked in the door, he ran and hid. They didn't know me. And his children didn't know me. And, you know, it seemed a shame. And, they always remember me coming home, because when I unpacked my kit bag, there was tinned fruit and God knows what, you couldn't get pepper, and you couldn't get pepper and stuff like that at that time. I brought as much as I could, what was short, you know.
So were you out of the army by this time, or were you still, serving?
Once we'd landed in England, the army, we found out that the army had no jurisdiction over us at all. So what happened in Bovington camp, they couldn't do nothing at all with us. That's why they'd held us over our time, you see. They got no, even the small print didn't cover them. Because once you land in this country, you're not abroad. They can hold you a year abroad, but they couldn't do that. So that's it. We knew we was on a good thing for kicking up a row, but anyway, I'd done good. We got home for Christmas, and I never saw any money, any of my wages come for. I was back at work. I suppose it'd be February before any of the back money come, what me paid, back pay come. It was February. And then, when I got back, I got back to work. See, I had to work. I don't know whether it was fortnight without money in them days before you got your first pay back. But the blokes had a collection for me at work and give me a pay packet. And they were all good fellas, you know. And then I started coming off again, but they run short of work, and I just changed my job. I went to Marconi's then.
Can I ask you how you felt about serving in the Korean War?
Very bitter about it, really, because it was a good thing we was there in a way, because I don't think they'd have been stable enough, even in the infantry regiments, if they hadn't had some reservists with a bit of servicing, because most of them had been through the Second World War. See, they joined up at the beginning for about 12 years, you see, and they just come in for it. They're 6 and 6, and they just come in for it.
And what about the political aspects of the war? Were you aware of the reasons for going to war?
Well, when we was out there, we saw things happen to the Korean people. Well, I mean, I've never mentioned any of that. I mean, we saw things happen to the Korean people, which would never be condoned in a civilised country. And I didn't reckon that their way of life at that time was anywhere near as compatible with ours. I mean, the poor buggers, they come through our lines when we was retreating for Seoul, and the infantry were inspecting them and taking, and every other bloke had got a bloody Yankee rifle. Where they come from, we was just piling them up and burning them, because we didn't know, you didn't know who was your enemy and who was your friend. And the value of life was terrible, really. The Asians, as the Japs and all that, have got a different outlook on what they had in that day. I don't know. They might be a lot better, but now, you know, the Korean people as such were all right. Well, I never had a lot to do with them, really.
How were you sympathetic towards that plight?
Oh, yeah, I was sympathetic. Well, the reason was, I mean, somebody got to stop at some time. If it hadn't been for us, it would have been somebody else. Otherwise, communism had just been. I mean, they'd been like the Japanese when they went over into Korea and took China and everything else. If you make the angst did stand the ground a bit, really. But they were totally unprepared, I should say, for the whole thing. MacArthur was like a god, and that was another point. When you went in Japan, I couldn't. We went to Tokyo and go around the shops, and the shopkeepers bow and all that, and you're thinking, yes, you're bowing now, but you've got a knife in your back, you don't trust it. You could. That was in your mind all the while, you know, that they had a different outlook on life.